We're live and in color here. It's November 11th in deference to Eddie Rott. And once again, good morning, Albert.
Good morning, David.
November the 10th, David.
Sorry, November 10th. I apologize. Thank you, Eddie.
The phones don't work. The date doesn't work. Okay.
Okay. Hopefully, we can launch ourselves into the one thing that we want to work, which is to generate a positive return in the last quarter of this year. Let's talk about the last quarter, Al. It's been an extremely challenging few months. It's been an extremely challenging few months for all macro strategies generally, but your global macro fund in particular has lagged. Your global allocation strategy, the asset allocation fund, has held up. We'll talk about the allocation fund in a minute, but first, let's discuss the leveraged global macro fund. I have two questions to start. First, I think that many investors want to know, and I include myself here, what explains the losses? And second, a more complex one. While we report monthly, which is the convention in the industry, that monthly reporting total investors still, though, can't help but see the monthly returns as a kind of score sheet. That score sheet, the monthly returns, may not match up with the assets or the views held by a manager. This is a long-winded way of asking you if some of the recently poor reports that investors have been getting are the results of poor trades or the results of ideas that are longer-term and worth suffering through.
Well, that's a long-winded one. Okay.
It's a long-winded one.
Okay, first... let's say it this way: the Global Macro Fund is down for the quarter, and that is what you call the quarter to date, right? That's the quarter to date, in the area of 9.6% or something of that sort. That's the number as of last night. Let's call it as of last night. The main losses in the quarter were actually taken in long securities. Stocks that we held and which during the market turmoil, the market went down and then suddenly turned up yesterday. But during that market movement, some of the groups that we had performed poorly, very poorly. For example, biotechnology was a poor performer. It's been going down for about 4 weeks or 6 weeks or so, anticipating a Clinton win and the potential ramifications of that for the healthcare industry. There was a very substantial loss in that sector, which fortunately in the last day is begun to recover. The housing sector was very poor, and this is a different discussion that we have to have, but it's had a very poor performance in the past few weeks. So that added to the negative. Oil and gas, well, we have a position in what's called the natural gas liquids and some natural gas positions, even though the entire position has been quite profitable, but in the past, again, the past few weeks, as oil came off from $50 plus to $44, $45, also suffered in the decline. So we've had three groups and concentrated, you know, as you know, we now are much more concentrated than we used to be, three groups that perform poorly and that dragged our results down. Airlines, we outed the airlines with a profit. We traded them out, but it was not a very significant gain.
Interrupt you for just a second. I'm finding it a little bit difficult to hear you. Could you speak a little bit more loudly, please?
Okay. So did you
That's
hear
better.
The last
Thank
part?
Thank you. Okay. Yes.
You heard the last part. Okay.
Yes.
So again, to explain the losses, 8% out of the 9.6, 8% of the losses, so roughly speaking, 85% of the losses, were accounted for by losses in three major groups in which we're long. Okay, so that's in long equities position. A smaller part, 1.8%, was accounted for by the drop in gold. So that explains entirely, I believe, the quarterly loss to date, and I'm talking to date.
And these are all positions that you've retained.
Yes, these are retained. Though I must say that we have been easing out of the home builder's position, kind of disappointed by the fact that they have, their order flow is not good. They're having major difficulty in selling, even though we have a shortage of housing in the U.S., of single residences anyway. We have a shortage of them, and prices have been going up. It appears that the rise in prices has created problems for in the demand, on the demand side, and has not allowed a quick enough response on the supply side. Probably having to do with permit problems and having to do with labor problems, having to find the proper labor to build. As we get into very low unemployment rates, you get a lot of problems in finding labor. And so the combination of those two things, even though the overall picture remains extremely bullish because we have a large gap in housing stock, the combination of two things has made the home builders a target for selling in the past few weeks, and so they have come off from the highs. So that's but we have retained some of the position, we have retained some of the NGL position, and we have retained the full biotech position, and those are our main long positions in equities. And that's where, as I said, that's where all the losses had been accounted for. We expect that these will recover, and that some of this ground anyway will be made up.
Thank you. Let's now turn to the asset allocation fund, what we call the global allocation strategy. It avails itself of the same macro views that you apply to the global macro fund, which is the leverage fund. But it's held up, and it's up in the neighborhood of 12% on the year. It's outperformed its macro peers elsewhere. Can you talk a little bit about the difference between the two?
Yeah, I have already outlined a number of times, I see in the last two letters anyway, some of the differences. But as you say, leverage has made a big difference. And another thing that made a tremendous difference is that where we failed quite badly in the global macro when we went short Asia prematurely and covered, we lost in Asia about 15% of the net asset value, which in effect, if you take that into account or if you X that out, I wish we could, but if we X that out, we actually would be up for the year. So that is something that the asset allocation did not do, fortunately, because the mandate doesn't allow it, so, and that's the main reason why we didn't do it. And as far as the quarter, for the actual quarter, the quarter to date, actually, the quarter to date, the asset allocation did lose 4.7%. So in a way, it was roughly following the way the global macro was doing, except it's less leveraged. So about half the losses.
We've talked about the portfolio so far only in terms of equities, but in the last quarter, the largest position or a position that you've devoted more attention to and more the capital of both funds to is in Brazilian bonds. Can you talk
right
about that?
Yeah, it's not the largest position. It's the largest single position. It's sort of close to the largest single position, but it has two sides to it, and that's what makes it the largest position. We own local currency Brazilian bonds. So you have a risk and an upside on the price of the bond, and that's one part of the equation. And the other part of the equation is you have a risk and an upside on the Brazilian currency, right? Because they're local currency bonds. So if you take both into account, we have reached a 80 to 90% exposure of assets on Brazil. So together, those two exposures make it the largest single exposure. And it's a little bit larger by now than the equity, the total equity exposure.
When you talk about 80, 90%, you're speaking about in the leverage
equity,
fund, but not in the...
In the asset allocation,
but you're talking about
30 plus times 2, so it would be a 60%.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about the strategy there?
Of course. The the Brazilian bonds, we've talked about them in the past. Inflation rates in Brazil are coming down a lot faster than expected by the majority of observers, including the central bank. And we are running now in the past 2-3 months, and I believe that we'll be getting down to even lower numbers. We're running at somewhere in the area of 2.5% annuals. The market had not expected anything of the sort by now. They expected at the end of next year to get to about 4.5-5%. We believe that we're going to be hitting very close to 0% inflation in the next 2 months on an annualized basis. So that makes the bonds yielding today about 11.5% very attractive. We think that those 10-year bonds, government bonds, should be trading closer to 7%, at the very least 7%. And so there's an important capital gain to be made there. We have to be patient. I mean, that won't happen in a day, but it has been moving our way, and we believe it will be moving in even a bigger way in the next few weeks, maybe 2-3 months. The other side of it is the play on the real is that in addition to the fact that Brazil is a commodity producer of sorts, and the background for that is good, we're moving into a good background, into a good area now, which commodity producers should do well. But in addition to that, Brazil is now implementing a number of important reforms. They're in the process now of implementing a cap government spending, a 20-year cap, which says that they basically cannot increase spending other than inflation-adjusted spending, cannot increase spending in an inflation-adjusted basis for the next 20 years. There's a small number of very small exceptions, but they're not really that relevant. So that's very, very important. It has, I believe, now two readings. It will get a third and final reading soon. They also are in the process of implementing a very large number of privatizations in the oil area and in other areas, and including in transportation, ports, etc. So that should attract a significant amount of capital. So I believe that all around Brazil is probably the best single name in the emerging market area. Because of reforms, because of the fact that they've gone through a 3-year very deep depression, the deepest since the Great Depression of the 30s, and the fact that they've had a purging of a lot of the political corruption that took place. So I believe that Brazil is very well positioned for a very important gain in the next 12 months.
Now there is a bit of a scandal brewing over a car wash in Brazil, and there have been protests in Rio. But at the same time, the inflation numbers for October were just announced, I believe, yesterday, and for the first time since 2000, they're below 8%.
Yeah, that's year over year. On an annualized basis, they're running about 2.5% or so, and as I say, it probably will get down to very close to zero in the next quarter.
Car wash, by the way,
is the scandal that was associated with Petrobras, which opened up the investigation into many, many important, prominent politicians and businessmen, and they have been sent to jail. So this is where the political purging has taken place, is because of that operation called car wash. So car wash is sort of the name that they gave it for this investigation, and it's been quite a radical change in Brazilian society.
Let's turn to what I think is on the minds of most people today, not even 48 hours after the election, and that's the effect of Trump's victory on financial markets generally, and on your book in particular. I know that the night of the election, you told me when the Dow was down 700 points in the futures market, you bought S&P futures, maybe not quite as heavily as you'd like to, but you saw it as an opportunity. At the same time, you bore the losses of a that you had to hold, or that you bore the losses that took place in the biotechnology industry and in your long positions generally. The stock market fell, I think, 8 consecutive days in anticipation of a Trump victory. How do you see it now?
Well, by the way, that was during the night. That was just a trade, and it was a way to, because for instance, the option markets were not open, and we had we owned puts, and so we thought that a way to trade against the puts was naturally by way of buying futures. But unfortunately, we didn't do enough of it. But at any rate, it was a successful and profitable operation. Okay, let's talk about the election, because now that's out of the way, and it deserves a little bit more of a comment, because Trump is inheriting a very complicated picture, and this is something I was referring to in my last quarterly report, that the picture coming out in the next while is going to be very complicated. And it's complicated because of a number of things that are happening. We are, at this moment in the U.S., in a late stage, late cycle in the economy. We have come a long way from 2009. We have gotten to the point that we are now fully employed, what you basically call full employment. The wage costs are beginning to rise rapidly. We may have gone under what's called there's a level at which unemployment, when you get to that level of unemployment, wages begin to accelerate. It is likely that we have reached that point, and we don't have to make new lows in unemployment in order to see wages continue to accelerate. Once you go below that, and let's say for simplicity, let's say that the unemployment rate is 5%, and that's the rate at which below that wages begin to accelerate. If that's the case, and unemployment stays below 5, or stays at 5 or below 5, we will see ever faster wage increases. And as an example, we have official statistics on some broad numbers like the average hourly earnings, and that's starting to move up. But more telling is, for example, there is the Atlanta Wage Track Survey. That's a very interesting measure of wage developments. That and it's a better one in a sense, because it focuses on continued full-time employed individuals, and you actually can follow them. It doesn't make any adjustments for demographics. Now, that measure, that survey, for the last quarter the third quarter, was up 3.6% year over year. 3.6% is a substantial number. In September, it was up 4.2% year over year. So we have now the beginnings of a wage acceleration, and we have seen that compensation now has increased steadily since the late 2014. Now, that is putting a tremendous amount of pressure on corporate profits, and we are now seeing corporate profits off the highs and still coming down. So that's late stage or late cycle development. It doesn't mean that you're going to have a recession tomorrow. It means that we are now moving towards the peak of the business cycle. So Trump is inheriting a situation where inflation is accelerating, productivity has been very low, and there's many reasons why that is the case, but we don't have to go into that. But it's a fact, productivity is very low, corporate profits are being squeezed, and then we have a very distressing fiscal position. What's happening, and this is unusual, historically unusual, this year, which is an expansion year, it's an expansion year. This year, we have a fiscal deficit increase. This is the first time that the fiscal deficit has increased in 3 years. We went to about just under $600 billion of a deficit. And it's at 3.2% of GDP, up from about 2.5% of GDP the year before. But that's extremely unusual, because you don't get expansion. You don't get an increase in the deficit during an expansion. Usually you get a significant narrowing, and that's because you get a lot of revenue from tax revenue, from income from corporations and individuals. So to see that happening is very distressing. And it's distressing because we have had flat defense spending, and it's almost inevitable that we will have an increase in defense spending under Trump. Just to just to probably bring us back to where we were a few years ago in view of the difficult political military situation around the world. We will have increase in defense. We have dealt with extremely low interest rates. So the Treasury has paid almost nothing for its debt. $14 trillion of debt has been accumulated. $8 or $9 trillion have been accumulated in the last few years. Any change in interest rates, if it's upwards, like for instance now, 10-year treasuries have gone from 1.5 to 2%, over 2%. It's a very significant hit to the government. So this small deficit, small, quote-unquote, 3.2% of GDP, in an expansion, is taken, has barely taken into account the possibility that we can have a blowout if just rates go up 100 or 200 basis points, let alone 300 or 400 basis points. So, again...
can you elaborate? What does this mean? A blowout? What does this mean? A blowout?
A blowout can mean that we can have a deficit. We can have a deficit of 5 or 6 or 7% of GDP. That's crisis.
But that's a critical situation. The effect of which will be what?
Very weak bond market, and that was a self-reinforcing, very weak dollar, a flight of capital from the U.S. It could get to what used to be in the 70s, a flight from the dollar in general, and that's critical.
There is something about Donald Trump, about his moral posturing,
the way he looks, sort of as a
throwback to the 1970s.
But David, let me just continue, because he's inheriting a terrible situation, potentially terrible situation. The most explosive of all is the entitlement situation. We have had an increase in Medicaid of 10%, it's gone up to 10% of the economy, $75 billion increase in Medicaid powered by Obamacare. So now entitlements are taking now 10% of the U.S. economy, and they're exploding upwards. They're exploding upwards. So nobody's talked about it. Trump hasn't talked about it. Clinton never talked about it. Nobody's talked about this explosive component. Right. There's no flexibility in this component of the budget. You can try whatever you want to do with infrastructure spending and other things that you have control over, but you have no control over this mandatory spending. And so, if we don't bring this monster back in, if you don't rein it in, I don't know how you can do it. You need very deep, a very very substantial reform, and he hasn't talked about it. That can almost bankrupt us in 10 years from now, or 5 years from now. It's not even 10 years, and maybe 5 years. So that's a very complicated situation. That's why I was mentioning that whoever was going to take over the economy today after this 8 or 12 years of basically mismanagement, let's call it mismanagement, or lack of attention in many respects also, waste of money, lack of attention to serious problems. Whoever is going to take it over, and especially somebody who's a populist, who wants to spend money, he's going to be facing a lot of constraints. Now, the positive side, I mean, I don't want to paint a completely negative side, but there's let me just say a couple, two more things, and then we'll get to the positive. There is a positive side to it, too. You know, the other problem is that corporate health is not good. We have increased debt now so much that it's equal to almost 100% of revenues. Any expansion, corporations have used debt, have borrowed very large amounts of money. Maybe you can't blame them because rates were very low. They've used the money to buy back shares. They've used the money to buy back shares and increase earnings per share. They have not used the money to spend on businesses, but they are in a vulnerable position because there is a lot of debt in the system, and that's one more point. And the last one is China. Unfortunately, we were premature there and took a short position in some financial stocks, and it didn't work out. But China is a serious problem. According to Moody's, and I'm using Moody's, which is a very, very reputable firm, and they don't exaggerate things. Bad debts in China are 10 times higher, they say, than officially acknowledged. 10 times higher. And that NPLs, non-performing loans, are equal to somewhere between 15 and 21% of GDP and rising very, very quickly. Now, that puts them not in the category of the U.S. and Britain during their highest or worst financial situation, but that puts them in the category of Ireland, Greece, Cyprus, countries that blew out totally. And of course, Cyprus and Greece had banking crisis and recapitalizations. So China is something that is waiting to happen. It's a disaster waiting to happen. They are devaluing slowly. By the way, we do have a position. We have a bet on a devaluation, a larger devaluation, but that's those are the options. So I now mention three areas that are difficult. Trump is inheriting a very delicate situation in terms of inflation, rising inflation, fiscal deficit that is widening, lack of attention to a problem that is crawling but exploding, I should say, which is entitlements. And then we have, on top of that, a corporate sector that's not very healthy in China, which is a disaster waiting to happen. Now, the positive side, if one is looking for positive side, and we are, is that he is promising a very substantial tax cut, corporate tax cut from 35% down to 15%. That is that could extend the business cycle for a long time to come. It will be the lowest tax rate in the developed world, and it could be quite a good development, and I believe that that's probably the single most important measure that he can do, other than repealing, or I wouldn't say repealing as much as changing the healthcare system or the Obamacare system to something that's a little bit more market friendly. And more and gives more choice. So and there's one more thing. There is talk, now that we have a Republican House and a Republican Senate with a Republican president, there is talk that there will be a revision of Dodd-Frank. And if there is a revision of Dodd-Frank, which is immensely complicated, immensely difficult, and which has put a color on the banking system, if there is such a revision, that's very positive. Positive for the banking business, for the intermediation business. So, complicated. Now, what does complicated mean? Complicated means that it's not all black and it's not all white, and but there are some major pitfalls, and it also means that we have to be a lot more selective today than ever before. It means that there are going to be only very selective plays. But there is going to be opportunities to make money, but selectively. It's not a broad advance. It's not a broad advance. It's a late stage advance. It's selective. It will drive all of us, I think, all of us in the business crazy, trying to find those things that make sense. I have some ideas about it, which we can discuss.
Is it reasonable to expect that the focus on the Federal Reserve will diminish somewhat and be transferred instead to fiscal policy? You say that it's been a tricky market. The market over the past several years has been largely a function of whether or not the Fed was going to raise rates or ease more, or either going to do QE, or whether Draghi was going to do QE. And the world's attention was directed there, and no matter what the fundamentals were of any particular asset, they were, by comparison, not as important as the decisions made by central banks. Is that likely to change now?
Well, it's not that they want to change. It's not that they're going to do it in an elegant way to say, okay, now it's your turn. That's not what's going to happen. What happens is that they're going to be facing the result of their activities over the past few years. We are now seeing inflation rising, and this is the main concern of the Federal Reserve. So, yes, the Federal Reserve will have to react to that. My guess is that the Federal Reserve will react very slowly, very reluctantly. They will raise rates, but, for example, you look now at the board, and you see that there's an expectation of nearly, let's say, almost 80%, that Fed funds will be increased in December. And then the market expects the Fed to raise rates by maybe 1.5 times, maybe another 35 to 40 points maximum by next December. But that's too slow. That's actually too slow. What's supporting the market's view is that there is going to be a substantial change, or let's call it not something, but a significant change in the composition of the Federal Reserve, of the FOMC. Three very very hawkish, or I can't say very. You can't say very about anybody there, but you can say hawkish. Three hawkish members are leaving, and they're being replaced by more dovish members. And so chances are that there's going to be a tremendous amount of inertia, and the Fed is not going to step and get ahead of the curve. It will stay behind the curve. What does that mean? Well, it means that the yield curve will slope upwards. It means that long-term rates are going higher. It means that if Trump comes through and what he was saying before about spending for infrastructure and spending more on defense and so on and so forth, and tax cuts, we're going to see an expansion of the federal deficit. We're going to see interest rates go up, right? We're going to see long-term rates go up. And we're going to see a Fed running after it. And that's not good. When the Fed runs after it, it's not good. That we learned in the 70s. When the Fed did that in 71, 72, 73, 74, 75, 76, 77, 78, until Volcker came, we chased inflation higher. So, yes, there's going to be a Passover. The Passover is not going to be a voluntary or elegant Passover. It's going to be forced. And the combination is not a good one. With a Fed in a defensive mode.
Well, you've characterized the scenario in front of us as complicated and very dicey, but at the same time, you've on several occasions described a scenario that sounds an awful lot like the 70s, and it's true. Nobody can expect that history will repeat itself, but the 70s were a period where there were tremendous opportunities.
That's right.
Both of us started in the investment business during the 70s.
Yes, and that brings me to where some of the opportunities may be, right? I think you're right. I think that allows for some very interesting opportunities. Where they are is probably going to be in the area of commodities and commodity producers. We are now only beginning to see some rises in base metals, whether it's zinc or nickel or copper and silver. So we may have a very strong commodity. I believe we're going to have a very strong commodity market. That's an opportunity. Commodity producers will do well, whether it's the BHP or whether it's Rio Tinto or whether it's Glencore or any one of the major producers will do well. So that's and in the 70s, there was a lot of money to be made in the commodity area. Now, this is taking a long time. Why is it taking such a long time? There are technical reasons why it's taking longer than it took in the 70s, but it's happening. And so I believe that there are opportunities, but it's more selective than it used to be till now.
Well, the one commodity that on the commodity front, the dark curtain would be China if, in fact, the credit bubble there were to blow up. Then a very large source of demand for industrial commodities would diminish, but the one commodity that really shines, forgive the metaphor, is gold. How do you see that?
Yes, yes, and both. Yes, that China a collapse in China, accompanied by a substantial devaluation, will have an effect, at least a temporary effect. I don't know if it's going to have a long-term effect, but it will have a temporary effect on the demand for commodities worldwide, okay? And especially something like oil, which can be hit very badly. The longer term, and during that period, I think gold should shine because it's a way for the Chinese population to own dollars if now they're having already some difficulty in buying dollars, you know, because of exchange controls. So that should do well. And again, as I say, silver and other base metals will do extremely well longer run. But because our system is so vulnerable, because our global system is so vulnerable, because of so much debt accumulated over so long, there will be periods, there will be breaks, there will be puncturings along the way that could be pretty painful.
I want to get to oil before we have 7 minutes to go. We try and end at 10:30. I want to get to oil, but before we do, I want to ask you two quick questions. First of all the debt that corporations have absorbed seems to be a prudent strategy for CEOs to have taken, given the interest rate environment. Can it not be reversed? In other words, if rates were to rise rather than refinance, can they not sell some of the equity that they bought and, in effect, sterilize some of that debt? That's one question. And the second question is, you've talked about poor liquidity in markets, and that relates to the Dodd-Frank issue, if I'm not mistaken. Can we talk about that? I know these are questions that generally lead to longer discussions, but can we try and speak about those at least briefly?
Yeah, okay. So let me go on to the corporate side. Corporations can't really buy their way out of their debts easily. It's not as if they bought buildings and now when they can sell the building. Most of that money, $620 billion in the last four quarters, went into buying back their own stock. So that's a lot of money, and they incurred a lot of debt in order to do that. So the only thing that they might be able to do is sell more stock. Yes, if they sell more stock, then they'll be able to start paying back debt. But selling more stock on that scale, you go from net buying $620 billion to net selling $620 billion, you have a market crash, right?
Yeah, so, you become a trader, in effect.
Yeah, so it's not such a pleasant way of getting out of it, that if they can sell stocks. So I think it's going to be hard for corporations to get out of it. It's going to be hard for them to roll the debt, even though now they're paying a little, and interest costs already are a significant factor in their income statements today. But even when they're paying little, it will be more and more difficult to roll over the debt in the years to come, because there's a lot of maturities coming up in 17, 18, 19, 20, a lot of maturities. So that speaks to the corporate debt side. And by the way, not all corporations are indebted. Again, you want to, moving forward, you want to be, if you want to be long, you want to be long those companies that were prudent all along and use the money usefully use the money properly, like by expanding their business and expanding their asset base, their productive asset base, and not just buying back stock. But as far as the other part,
liquidity and Dodd-Frank.
Liquidity, yes. Well, Dodd-Frank was not directly affected stock liquidity, or stock trading. It has a very pronounced effect on the bond market. And the fact is that we have a very, very fragmented bond market today, and it's very difficult to sell large quantities of bonds today without moving prices. There are not that many market makers. There are a lot of players in this market, and bids disappear very rapidly. And that's been reported widely. I mean, we know that. So, yes, liquidity.
This is because investment banks have been obliged really to step away from the deal.
Because they're not able to trade for their own account anymore for market making,
I mean.
For their own account, right? I mean, they can only trade to accommodate the client, and but it's not for their own books. So their books are actually thinning, and thinning books means less liquidity. The stock phenomena is different, and I believe that here we have really a market that's fully bought in a way. And by the way, a lot of the buying was corporate buying, right? Corporates buying back stock. That's probably been the single largest bullish factor in the stock market has been corporations buying back stock. I mentioned before $620 billion. That was a major, major net buyers, because the retail public, for example, was a seller of stocks all this period, right? They've been selling through redeeming mutual funds, ETFs, and so on. So the liquidity in the stock market is poor. It's extremely poor. And we don't want to go through, we don't want to go through a decline in this condition, because it will need much more volume to clear. And so, again, I believe that we are late stage, at least from an economy point of view. I believe that Trump can extend it by especially through tax cuts. I think that the life of corporations is frail, so it's going to be difficult now that it's so highly indebted. There's going to be a selective process here. I think that there's going to be money to be made, a lot of money to be made in the commodity side of it. All in all, I think we have to be very cautious. This is an economy that has built itself on a lot of debt, a lot of easy money, and central banks have really created a trap for us in the future. But what in addition to that, what where the trap has been is the fact that administrations, whether it's Europe or whether it's the United States or anywhere, did not pay attention to the entitlement explosion. And that's going to kill us, literally kill us, in the next few years. Something has to be done there.
Al, let's very quickly end with oil. Just a brief comment on it, if you have one. I know you don't have a trade on.
We don't have a trade on. We don't have a trade on, right? We don't have a trade on, and that's because I'm generally always been I've been nervous about the fact that oil is now the subject of it's a major bone of contention today in the Middle East between Saudi Arabia and Iran. I think the lines have been marked. I think that that the Saudis want to increase production and market share, that the Iranians are competing with them, that the Iranians are upset with the Saudis are upset with the Iranians. It's a power play, and that power play cannot end well. It just cannot end well, especially in a market that is oversupplied, and thanks to fracking in the U.S. And I understand that one of Trump's plans is to open up fracking wider, so we can have much more fracking all over the United States, and that could be even more bullish for U.S. oil, meaning for U.S. production. So the pressures on Saudi Arabia and Iran are great. That, in my view, inevitably leads to conflict. And so I'm always concerned being short the oil market, simply because there could be an eruption, and that could be a very quick spike, and that could be very, very painful. But generally speaking, the price of oil should go lower, and we should see, in my view, we should see a break of the $26 low that we saw last year. U.S. production is increasing. Global production is increasing. We have OPEC at almost 34 million barrels a day. This is after everybody's increasing production, everyone. And the idea that anybody's going to stop increasing is nonsense. The Russians, which everybody thought that when they hit 10.2 million barrels a day that they would not make it when the price came down, they are making it. And they're making it because they're able to manipulate the currency and the tax rates in such a way that favors oil producers, and therefore they can now continue to step up production. They're up to 11.5 million barrels a day. So the oil gusher is on. I mean, we have a lot of oil coming out, and there will be more oil coming out, and the oil will go down to its marginal cost. Marginal cost in the Middle East is, I don't know, maybe $5, maybe $10. In the U.S., marginal cost is going down every day, and maybe it will get down to $20 a barrel, $18 a barrel. Watch out. All those guys that have costs of $40, $15, $60, they're out. They're out. They're going to be out. So oil is a commodity in decline, and we don't need anything else. We don't need a switch to alternatives or anything else. Simply production increases. Enormous production increases in oil and in gas.
Thank you. Al, your difficult quarter, you started off nicely in the month of November. You played the election well. You didn't liquidate any of those equity securities, it sounds like, in anticipation of, in fear, rather, of a Trump victory. And your reward, I think we're up 2.5-3% so far this month. And I wish you well. I wish you well for the rest of the year, and look forward to talking to you in January. And we hope we'll be after a better reporting period. Thanks for your time today.
Okay. Thank you, David. Bye bye.
Bye bye, Al. Just a little note to listeners that the a podcast of today's session will be posted on the Friedberg website and on the Niagara website sometime later today. Thank you very much for your attention. Good luck with your investing.